19 states have seceded.
The United States Army ramps up activity.
The White House issued warnings to the Western forces as well as the Florida Alliance.
The three-term president assures the uprising will be dealt with swiftly.
Let me know if you want to try anything on.
I'm guess aware there's like a pretty huge civil war going on all across America.
We just try to stay out. With what we see on the news, seems like it's for the best.
This is Yanks and Krauts, issue number, I think it's 11, Austin.
I think we're on 12. No, we're on 11,
yeah,
correct.
That's awesome.
Well, congratulations.
So we are going to talk about a movie this week.
I thought we were going to talk about the Civil War.
It's a movie.
Oh, the movie, the Civil War. No, we're actually having kind of a civil Cold War in the country right now.
Yeah, and it's a dystopian movie that has been super successful with the critics and at the box office, grossing more than double its $50 million production budget. The film has received mostly positive reviews ranging from good to very good, and the movie was written and directed by Alex Garland, a British director, and some of you might know one of his first successful movies. That was 28 Days Later, a British production. I think it's almost 20 years old.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, I saw it. I loved it. It's also, all his movies seem to have a dystopian theme. And then, of course, he wrote a very famous novel like 15 years ago, or no, 20 years ago, called The Beach. And it also became a movie with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Leonardo DiCaprio, yeah.
Yeah. And I just recently saw The Beach again, and it was so boring. Nothing compared to Civil War.
So this Civil War, this movie stars Kirsten Dunst, and there's a claim, and I heard Dunst say this as well in an interview, that
her name is Dunst. Kirsten Dunst.
She comes from your hometown.
No, she doesn't.
Oh,
she was born in the U.S., but she has dual citizenship. She's German, and her parents are Germans. Her mother used to work for Lufthansa, and her father used to work for Siemens. And they were both expats that had moved to the U.S., and she was born in New Jersey.
And one of my favorite actresses.
Oh.
So anyway, people are claiming that the film is devoid of politics. It kind of starts and sets you. There's already a civil war going on. It's dystopian, near future America. There are secessionists who have emerged in the film, and the film starts essentially in the middle of combat. The violence escalates. We are introduced to a leader that seems to be fascistic. He puts on a kind of a strong man front, and
reminded me very much of Donald Trump, to be honest.
Well, I think despite the claims that that's not intended, I think that is the logical conclusion. Most people are saying, well, you couldn't really see. But I'm going to argue today that you can kind of see what the sides
and
are.
You can hear in the movie that he is president in his third term.
The film is a warning to Americans. I don't know if we need this film to be warned. And by not being overtly clear in its message, it might just end up being another shooting movie, like most zombie movies. In fact, much of The Train reminded me of the made-for-TV, the special series, The Last of Us. It really has that look, minus the moldy zombies. But anyway, I'm afraid it just becomes a shooting movie, fueling the fantasies of doomsday preppers and the like. So that aspect of the film kind of worries me.
Mm-hmm. I found the movie very interesting, and because it portrays the possibility of a civil war in the U.S., God forbid that may ever happen again. And when we consider, for example, the storming of the Capitol, it doesn't seem that implausible. In my opinion, it's not crucial who is fighting whom in the movie, or where the troops coming from, or if California and Texas fight together, or if they are rivals or not. What I did not like so much is that the movie had some really heavy graphic elements that I think were unnecessary, but on the other hand, I think the depiction of violence makes this movie very realistic. I've never seen sound effects and visual effects so realistic, especially, you know, when you hear a bullet flying by, that's like crazy.
Citizens of America,
the so-called Western forces of Texas and California
have suffered a very great defeat at the hands of the United States military.
Mr. President, do you regret the use of airstrikes against American citizens?
We're moving to D.C. today.
We need to go down there.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol.
Every instinct in me says this is death.
Blood it.
Every time I survived the war zone, I thought I was sending a warning home. Don't do this. But here we are.
There's some kind of misunderstanding here.
What?
Well, you're American, okay?
Yeah, it was a deliberate effort on the director's take to make sure the shooting was loud and constant. And it was one of those cases where my understanding from the interview I saw was that they were loud on the set when they were filming. They were using a loud squib or blank ammunition as opposed to relying on the Foley artists to increase the combat. They wanted people to feel it and to be nervous and to jump for real. So yeah, that was a deliberate, and I agree. So the sound is pretty jarring. You know, I was thinking about something. So it seemed to me that about 20, 30 years ago, we had the movie Red Dawn. Had you ever seen Red Dawn? It's Russian and Cuban soldiers invade the United States in a surprise attack, and a group of kids in, I want to say,
wasn't it
Michigan?
Wasn't it Korean?
Or not? The idols. That's the point I'm making. So about 30 years ago, Red Dawn, American, basically country boys, farm boys, teenagers. Mm-hmm. Teenagers take up the fight against Soviet and Cuban soldiers in the heartland
movie.
Of America.
I remember that one, yeah.
I actually thought that was a pretty good film. And then a few years ago, the movie was remade. Mm-hmm. And this time it was North Korea backed by the Chinese who were the assailants. Right. This seems
I saw that movie.
Yeah, I think this is this one for this period, this decade, and it's a civil war. So we've gone from exterior threats
to interior threats.
I was kind of kidding before, but I think we've been engaged in this civil Cold War for quite a while. So if this is a warning film, I wish it had come earlier, and I also wish it had been more explicit.
That is true, but we already heard statements in the past few years. It not only started with the Capitol, the riot at the Capitol, but and of course it was foreseeable that Hollywood would take over that one. But I think the grim scenario of a civil war is quite compelling. I believe that many scenes in the movie are very well executed. For instance, the depiction of trigger-happy individuals taking up arms and shooting anyone who crosses their path. Law and order no longer holds sway in the U.S., leading to the economic grinding to a halt. And, for example, the U.S. dollar plummets in value, prompting the Canadian dollar to become the substitute currency. And, these are all very subtle details, seamlessly woven into the narrative of the movie. And I think it's a very well-made movie. It is not the typical Hollywood blockbuster action movie. The movie left me very irritated.
Yeah. I actually do want to talk about like sort of the political leaning of the film, which I think is evident. You mentioned the Canadian dollar becoming the supreme currency, which, I mean, maybe
that's a nice reference.
Maybe that's
for
the warning,
because
despite what you think of the current administration, the American dollar is still right now the strongest currency in the world, I believe.
Absolutely. It's the leading currency.
Yeah. And it has been, and it will be. And if you're a patriotic American and you want the Canadian dollar to become the world currency, currency, then yeah, push for a civil war. So anyway, a lot of people discussing the film say there's this strategy to not, you know, choose a side or to demonstrate a side or to talk about what starts the war. But I think those things are there, and they may have decided at some later point to not alienate part of the audience. But this is what I saw in the film. The film is mostly, before I talk about the war aspect, I think one of the things that confused me or bothered me is I wasn't sure what the focus of the film was. Despite the title of the film, it really is a Star is Born kind of story about a young reporter who's rising on the heels. She has natural talent, and she's a photographer, and she's rising on the heels of a more experienced reporter, the Kirsten Dunst character, who is near the end of her career. And, you know, and people are trying to, you know, so that's what the story is really. I think that ended up being the main story on the background of a Civil War.
It is the main story. And I think it's the weakest part of the film, that's the whole narrative. But they needed some, probably that's what I thought, what Alex Garland did. He wanted to have some stars in the movie that could lead through the story to tell other parts and to, you know, put in all these crazy things that happened during the movie. But I think that's the weakest thing of the movie.
Right. And it could be developed more. I don't want to give away too much, but I think it could have been developed a little bit more. I saw the other night a 2015 movie called A Perfect Day about NGO workers, non-governmental, these were health workers, water supply seems to be their focus, NGO workers in the Balkans during this Serbo-Croatian conflict, the war in Yugoslavia, that area of the world. And it's very similar, but they really lean into the relationship of the people working. And in fact, they have the one new person on the team who's learning how to cope in this war zone. And the film has kind of a war is absurd. There's like this absurdity around this mission they're on to actually clean a well. I don't want to say too much to give that movie away, but I highly recommend that film. A lot of people felt it was a bit slow, but I think that's the part. I mean, you know, for a lot of people, the war is the other stuff. These people are driving from water, you know, well to well, trying to find equipment to clean these wells. Anyway, so I would recommend that film. It felt very similar to me.
But what I wanted to say, Austin, is also, and Alex Garland is famous for that, and I remember 28 Days Later, who was also a dystopian movie about a virus that kills almost everyone in the UK. In this movie, the fun part, if you will, is that you are interested to see what happens to a society like the society in the US when there is a civil war. What will change? What will be a realistic scenario? And I think he painted a lot, or he gave a lot of examples of what could happen if we really have to face a civil war, when there are two or more factions fighting each other in this country, what will happen to the economy, what will happen to people, what will change for people who live in more remote areas, how will they react, how will they cope with the whole situation, how will Manhattan look like. Yeah. We might have terrorist groups who commit like suicide commandos and all of that stuff.
Yeah, and sadly, I think it would be worse than the film depicted.
I think that too.
You know, they're although the country is pretty spread out. Let me go ahead and talk about this idea of politics in the film. For me, the politics were clearly anti-MAGA. And I'll tell you a couple of things. So in film, you only have a few elements to go by because films tend to be fairly quick and a director makes, you know, a few dozen choices that are key. And one is that any character that looks like what we imagine a MAGA character to be, any character that, you know, looks like you might see them at a Trump rally, they're unlikable, they're criminal, they're cruel, they're racist. And I know that many Americans on the right project those same things on liberals. And some liberals I'm sure are racist and detestable, and there are plenty of liberals I don't like or find very likable. But the liberals I know are not as well armed as the MAGA part of the country. And I think that's measurable. Also, the combatants in the film have much more camouflage clothing than any liberal I know. I don't know any liberal that shops at a hunting store. So you kind of see who's prepared for this conflict. And that suggests to me a certain political leaning. Also, we know about two things about this president. You know, we're given two, maybe three pieces of information, but I think most of them fall into these two categories. One, we know that in an interview, he's asked about his third term, which suggests that the president in this film has already defied the Constitution to remain in office. And in our history, that's only come up a couple of times. And in recent history, you know, it's only President Trump who's been, you know, joking about being, you know, a leader for life, like he admires the president of China for having been elected leader for life. Putin. And Putin. So there's that element, which tells me this is a Trump-like character. He's also a physical coward. But he pretends to be a tough guy. Mm-hmm. He talks tough. You see him actually rehearsing a speech that he's going to make.
Right at the beginning of the movie.
And he's in denial. He's in denial about how bad it is. Sounds very Trump-like to me. You know, he's basically saying everything's going to be okay. The conflict's nearly over. This sounds like Trump and COVID. And he's talking tough and he's rehearsing that, but then he proves to be a physical coward. So there's that. And then to the combatants in the film, the different factions, it seems some are, you get the impression that some troops, American soldiers from the East Coast remain loyal to the president, to the film president in this film. But the rebel forces or the forces trying to unseat this president are referred to as the Western forces.
Coming from California and Texas.
Correct. And if you look at that as a visual symbol in the film, the Western forces are very regular, what we say regular army. Mm-hmm. They're very military.
Absolutely, yeah.
They've got
organized.
They've got the planes. They've got the trucks. They have airlift capabilities. Mm-hmm. They're literally, we see them doing airlifting of trucks and supplies. You know, they have bases. Sounds very regular military to me. And then they even have embedded reporters. Like there's a group of these group of reporters know each other, and then there's the independents, like our main characters, and then they run into colleagues or friends of theirs who are actually embedded with this army. That all sounds very regular military to me, which suggests to me, and even though it's counterintuitive that Texas and California would be working together, but the way our military works, you have guys in Texas from everywhere in the country. You have guys in California from everywhere in the country. And the fact that they're being loyal to the chain of command suggests to me that this is a large, and it's, I don't think I'm giving away too much saying that this appears to be the side of the conflict that's winning. That the large organized military appears to be a military that was established to fight an unconstitutional president, not established, but stepped up under the leadership of their military command to fight an unconstitutional president. You know, we have that saying that you take an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So to me, here's the bottom line. The backdrop of the film is a war caused by a president who unconstitutionally manages to stay in office for a third term. And he manages to get the support of part of his military, militia groups, some individuals who appear to be taking advantage of the chaos. They seem to be, you get the feeling they might be in support of this president. They jump into the conflict for a variety of reasons, criminal, racist, whatever. And the fact that the racists jump into this, I hate to say it, but that sounds a little bit like the current administration we have in the country now. And then the actual story is really a story about a reporting coming to terms with the end of her career.
Austin, I agree. You can read all that out of the movie, but I think, and I might have read it in an interview with Alex Garland, the director and writer of the movie.
I wouldn't believe him. He has to say that now. He's trying to sell tickets.
Yeah, but
what did he say?
No, I'm not sure. That's my personal opinion. I think we should not read too much into that because this movie just wants to give examples and a lot of examples how a civil war would probably, and it probably will be, as you said, worse, look like in the US. It is not so much about that. I think that it was not Garland's intention to make us think, oh, now what's going to happen between the liberals and the conservatives and who's going to fight who. I think that's not important. I think he wants to, it's a shock and awe movie.
Yeah.
You're like captivated by the thought that it could come to a second civil war in this country, and that Americans would fight Americans.
I think as a filmmaker, you have to, in the back of your head, have a plausible idea to make the rest of the film seem real. And the plausible idea is a constitutional crisis.
But that exactly was the point that the New York Times criticized about the movie, that it was so indecisive in its...
I think the New York Times is missing it. I see it. The bad guys look MAGA. The president sounds MAGA. The constitutional crisis is his staying in office for a third term. That's the crisis that seems to trigger this conflict, and the regular military steps up against him.
Yes, Austin, but Garland needed to have such an approach because sure. to make the movie interesting, to lure people to the box office to watch it. But I think it doesn't play that role that some people would like to read from the movie. It's more like a backstory, and it's the for example, there's this one very devastating scene where we see a meadow, it's summer, and God knows why, there is some Christmas music playing in the background. And then there were two snipers lying in the grass shooting at a house. And they just say, they're being asked, what are you doing here? And they said, yeah, there's another sniper in that house over there.
We're shooting at him because
we're shooting at him because he's shooting at us.
Yes.
And that's like, that's the whole, and it says so much about having a civil war, what it means. It's so useless.
That's
one of the messages, and that's one of the examples, and it has many more.
That's the moment of absurdity. The whole thing ends up being absurd in that moment. What I find interesting is that the film starts with a battle scene, it starts with a protest.
In a protest,
there's a battle scene, and you don't know who's on what side.
Yeah.
But then it starts to become more and more clear.
Yeah.
You're right. The scene that you talk about, absolutely, there's the absurdity of that. And we quickly go from that to me, I think it's fairly clear. And that's fine. He can claim that it's a warning movie about how bad it will be if it happens. But I also,
I know his history and I know his previous movies,
right.
And 28 Days Later is a perfect example. Yeah. He loves to indulge in such situations. What's going to happen to a society, for example, in 28 Days Later, when there is a virus and kills everybody else and all human beings mutate into these zombies and there are only a few people who were able to survive. But yeah. Last, let me ask you this question. Is it, in your view, worth watching?
I honestly say if you're at all squeamish, don't.
Really?
Yeah, I don't.
It wasn't worth the, how much did we pay for the movie?
To me, the message of the movie is that a constitutional crisis is what's going to trigger a civil war. And that, and then your message, which I think they go together, is that, and a civil war is absurd. It will do nothing but deplete this country's strength and power, and we will end up using Canadian currency as the strong dollar.
Who wants to use Canadian dollars?
Americans don't.
Exactly.
I mean, I read and that I line. See, that was when I started to kind of get hints, because I sort of laughed, but I laughed as in, oh, there's an irony. If you start a civil war because you think you want to make America first, well, guess what? You're going to be using someone else's currency before it's over. And the last civil war we had, American currency became almost useless, as was Confederate currency until the war was over. So, so for me, I thought I could see the message despite any attempt to pretend to be neutral. Now, that's probably a worthwhile message, but here, bottom line, if you understand fully that a constitutional crisis can lead to a civil war and you want to avoid a civil war, then you have to avoid a constitutional crisis. And if you know that already, you don't need to see the film.
I think this is a very entertaining movie, although the topic is highly disturbing, but it's still worth watching. And for those who have missed the movie, it will be for a couple of more weeks in movie theaters, but I think it'll come out on the usual platforms in June, so you can watch it at home as well. It's not out yet. You can't buy it. I just wanted to watch it the other day again. So let's talk about our other topic. Donald Trump is facing his hush money trial right now in New York, and it's going to be very interesting. We can expect a verdict soon, I guess. Maybe this week.
Not this. Maybe next week, because they haven't done cross yet of all the witnesses. And anyway, but I think we're getting pretty close. I think. Yeah. So anyway, but before we do that, let's just recap real quick. So the fraud case in New York, Trump lying about his valuations on his property. He lost that case. It's a civil case, so it has no impact on his.
And he appealed the verdict.
And he appealed the verdict, so he hasn't paid yet. And then the federal documents case.
Florida.
In Florida, under Judge Cannon, she has deferred indefinitely because there are too many appeals and motions for her to, even though she's the one who controls the timeline, she said she can't set a schedule because there's too much to do.
So deferred means it indefinitely, so that trial will never
theoretically
start, or?
And I think if she had a couple of smart clerks, they could sit down with her and go through all the motions and appeals probably in about 2 days and come back and say, okay, we're ready to set a trial date for whatever next week or something. But clearly she does not want to do that. She is dragging her feet at every step and indefinitely deferred. She could come back any day and say, we're going to resume the trial on this day, but she hasn't. And we don't know. It's entirely in her hands now.
A Trump-appointed judge.
And one that has either demonstrated extreme slowness, incompetence, or bias.
Or so, all of it.
Or all of it. And then Georgia's also delayed. The Georgia case on the election, attempt to throw the election, that one's on appeal, looking at whether or not the prosecutor's office can, what's her name? Fannie Willis can continue
this case.
That is
really unfortunate. She did such a great work. And then
ultimately doesn't matter. Nope. It ultimately doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like I said before, this is an HR problem. This is a human relations
absolutely.
Office problem.
That's what I wanted to say. It's like if she hadn't had that affair with that other prosecutor, that trial.
And it also shows, I have a feeling that would not have happened for anybody else in any court. Absolutely. You know, if you're a petty thief, you don't get the appeals that Trump's getting. So it is a two two-tiered justice system. Trump's getting every break.
And then DC, the DC case, right? That's the other one that's left, right? The fourth case.
Yeah, so that one is also on appeal. We're waiting for the Supreme Court to
make a decision.
About whether or not the president's immune from prosecution for inciting a violent
insurrection. And it looks like he even might get support from some of the conservative Supreme justices.
We're kind of waiting to see. Do these justices want to establish their independence from the president? Because they're on the court for life, and many justices, get this position, and then within a year or so, they're making it clear that they're not in the president's pocket. So it all comes down to the hush money case, which really should be. I think I said this before. It's making falsifying business records so that you can pay a bribe to affect an election. I mean, there's got to be another title for it, but this is the one. I'll tell you the one thing that I found interesting in the last week when Stormy Daniels was testifying. Mm-hmm. She's a Republican.
How so?
She was asked what her politics were, and she is a Republican. All the people lining up to help convict Trump, to get rid of Trump, are people that worked for him or were in his cabinet or are Republicans. Yes, Democrats will absolutely push and take advantage, and they want to power in government. But the number of Republicans there, or the people that worked for him, and even if, remember when President Trump said he was going to fill his cabinet with all of the best people? I still don't know what he meant by that.
They all turned against him.
They certainly weren't best in his mind. Best means loyal.
Bar his general.
And the most competent people all left. The attorney general Barr is saying that he will still vote for Trump.
He said that. I saw the interview on CNN, but he was he had problems to really give good reasons for it.
Yeah.
And he was...
There are no good...
of course, there are not good
reasons. His reason is that anybody would be better than Biden.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's his reason, is that he follows the idea, and I don't see it, but that's my bias maybe, but that Biden is some sort of communist who's just wrecking everything.
Which is bullshit, of course.
Even though the data doesn't support that.
Yeah.
For me, an interesting thing that's happening too is that we're the vice presidential sweepstakes has moved into the courtroom. So after
what do you mean by that?
So after a couple of weeks of people noticing that no one is sitting with Trump to support him other than his lawyers, Eric shows up. Only one child, and it's Eric. So Eric draws the short straw, and his dad makes him come stand in the courtroom. Because keep in mind that a big part of this has to do with an affair that he had. And, what you want to see is the wife there. He reconciled. Because Trump's trying to say that this whole thing of him paying hush money
never happened.
One, he's trying to say it never happened. And two, he's trying to say that even though there were rumors of his infidelity, he was trying to protect Melania. So no one's standing with Trump. Melania's definitely not there. His daughter's not there. So anyway, Eric shows up. Michael
Johnson?
No.
Oh, Michael Cohen?
Michael Cohen,
his fixer,
in fact,
his former
testified
attorney,
that Trump said he didn't care what his wife thought. He testified that Trump he wanted to delay making the payments because if he lost the election, he wasn't going to bother because he didn't care what Melania heard about this affair. He only cared about winning the election. Now, in the cross, that may be taken down as an idea, but there's that. Yeah, you're talking about Michael Johnson. So he actually showed up in court as well. Senator, I actually think, even though he's not standing up with the whole group at Mar-a-Lago and other places, I think he's a candidate for VP. There's a good chance he's going to lose his speakership. He's still the tenuous speaker. He did survive. I wasn't sure he was going to. I predicted that. I started calling him tenuous speaker of the House. Marjorie Taylor Greene did motion to vacate the chair, and he did survive that with the help of Democrats, but the Democrats can pull that vote in a second. You know, they their interests are not his interests politically. So anyway,
but the Democrats showed responsibility. They showed, hey, we have.
That's even, what they're campaigning on. Yes.
Yeah. This is even he's a bad speaker. There are worse people than Johnson.
Right. Right. And but here's my thinking. If the Democrats take the House, he's out. Right. He's got the speakership now, like by one vote.
But doesn't Trump need a African American VP?
I don't.
In order to try to activate voters that are lost, that still vote for.
So are you thinking about Scott?
Yeah. No. What? Yeah. And what's her? What's the name? The last we spoke about. We spoke about her so many times, a Republican who lost against Trump or who gave up.
Nikki Haley.
So because, you know.
He's still saying that she's not a candidate for the position.
Right, right. But I didn't mean
he
that.
He needs
but
her.
So many people in the past elections voted for her. Yeah.
In primaries.
Yeah, right. Although she's not on the ballot anymore.
Correct. She's on the ballot, but she's no longer running.
Yeah. Right.
So in places where her name's already been printed on the ballot, I think she just got 20% in some state.
Exactly.
Well, that's who the Republican Party needs.
And that's why I said that Trump might need Scott for.
But here's
SVP.
The thing. Scott was hemming and hawing the other day about whether or not he thought Trump had won the election. I mean, he couldn't get a word out. He doesn't seem strong. I don't find him terribly likable. I don't know if anybody in the African-American community looks at him as a leader. Now, that would be a shallow reason to go for him. What Johnson brings is the religious vote. Even though this hyper-Christian, you know, what are your policies, Mr. Johnson? Look at the Bible and you'll see them there. And I'm thinking, has he read the Bible recently? He should have been at least pinned down Old Testament, New Testament, because the Old Testament's got all kinds of rules about keeping slaves, which would worry me if I heard a politician saying the Bible was his document. But anyway, I guess that's the calculation Trump might be making. Is he really going to get that much of the black vote? And if he's not, he needs to keep the religious, because the one group who believes he was worth it despite all of his shortcomings are the religious right, because he got the Supreme Court stacked against abortion.
That's what I wanted to say. He has them already. He doesn't need to prove that he can help them more by giving Johnson such a position, because he needs to attract more female voters. He needs to attract people in the suburbs, and he most probably can't do that with a VP called Johnson.
Yeah, or maybe he's just counting on Johnson to come out of the courtroom and to talk about what a repentant, good Christian Trump is. Maybe that's his only reason for being there.
It's interesting that half of the campaign of the U.S. presidential campaign now happens in a courtroom. That is really interesting.
And then Trump's saying that, it's a plot to keep him from campaigning, yet he hasn't really gone out and campaigned that much. He had a big thing in New Jersey near the courtroom just a few days ago. But yeah, he's not out there on every Wednesday and on every weekend campaigning. And we're also waiting to see if he's actually going to go to his... He is supposedly going to go to his son's graduation, because he criticized the court for not giving him a day off, because his strategy seemed to be delay, delay, delay. And so one of the things was they're stopping him from campaigning. They're stopping him from spending time with his family. His family never shows up. They're stopping him from going to his son's graduation. And the judge said, okay, you can have that day off. So the day of the graduation, he has it off, but he's scheduled a rally for something like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which has to be minutes after the graduation. So I don't know. I don't know what he's up to. He's a pretty unlikable character.
What a good word for the ending of our podcast. Austin, see you next week.
Take care.